This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Today, a look at Indigenous and Native stories that we've talked about this year with you. So it's good to have you with us. Let's get started.
We will not intentionally separate children from their parents. We will not do that. We are better than that. We are so much better.
That is the unmistakable voice of the late Congressman Elijah Cummings, speaking in 2018 during a meeting of the House Oversight Committee, convened to discuss the Trump-era policy of separating minor children from their families at the southern border. As a civil rights activist and the son of sharecroppers, I suspect the late Representative Cummings knew that his assertion of America being, quote, better than this, was more aspirational than factual. In fact, our national history is replete with examples of willful separation of children from their parents.
I was sold first to Ben Davis, a slave trader, and my daughter was sold to a stranger. I fell on my knees before Mr. Davis and begged him to buy my daughter from the stranger. His hardened heart must have been touched by my agony because he walked over to the stranger and offered to buy my patience. But the stranger refused to sell her. And he went away a few hours later. I have never seen my daughter since.
That's the voice of a young actor performing a true story as part of a program titled Last Scene, which was staged in February 2019 by Villanova University's Departments of History and Theater. She's reading one of the thousands of information wanted ads taken out by formerly enslaved people who were forcibly separated from their families during American slavery. These ads show that even decades after families were scattered by the sale of human beings as chattel, people still wondered about, yearned for, and searched for their loved ones. In 1941, Nikki Nojima Lewis saw her father arrested by FBI agents during her fourth birthday party. He was guilty only of being a Japanese immigrant. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, tens of thousands of Japanese American families were separated and incarcerated across the American West. Nikki Nojima Lewis spoke about her experience in a 2019 interview with New Mexico Public Television.
Hey, you know, I've had a childhood in camp, but my father was taken away. And although, you know, I was with my mother in a concentration camp in Minidoka, Idaho, in the desert of Minidoka, Idaho, one of 10 war relocation authority camps.
The 19th century separation of enslaved families, the 20th century separation of Japanese American families, the 21st century separation of migrant families. All rest on a brutal government practice which for more than a century forcibly removed hundreds of thousands of indigenous children from their parents, families, and tribes in both the U.S. and Canada. These children were taken to so-called boarding schools to be stripped of their language, culture, traditions, and identities through a policy of forced assimilation. Like the newly emancipated who took out newspaper ads for their loved ones, the families and communities of these indigenous children have never ceased yearning and searching. Back in June, U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced a new initiative to investigate the, quote, loss of human life and lasting consequences of this practice of family separation.
I know that this process will be long and difficult. I know that this process will be painful. It won't undo the heartbreak and loss that so many of us feel. But only by acknowledging the past can we work toward a future that we're all proud to embrace.
That was Secretary Haaland addressing a virtual conference of the National Congress of American Indians. The U.S. government's announcement follows similar efforts in Canada, which resulted in the discovery of the remains of 215 Indigenous children buried outside a boarding school in British Columbia, as reported in late May. Since then, another 751 unmarked graves were found near the site of a former school in Saskatchewan. Overall, an estimated 6,000 children died at schools in Canada. According to government officials, many of the children were physically and sexually abused. If we are to be better than this, as Representative Cummings believed we could be, then we must begin by facing and addressing what happened here. Back in June, I spoke with Nick Martin, who is now an editor for the Indigenous Affairs Desk at High Country News and a member of the Saponi Tribe. Nick, talk to me about why. Why are we now seeing an initiative like this in the U.S.?
First and foremost, being that Deb Haaland is the Secretary of the Interior. Deb Haaland is a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo and is the first Native official to be appointed to a cabinet position in United States history. I mean, so her presence in the Interior, which oversaw many and funded many of these schools, cannot be overstated. And I wrote in a column this past week in the New Republic, kind of pointing this out, both as a measure and a testament to Secretary Haaland's obviously overwhelming support for tribal consultation and listening to what tribal communities need. But it is also an indictment of, I think, every Interior official who came before her in a leading position that chose not to take similar action. This is something, as you mentioned, Canada has kind of undergone this already with their Truth and Reconciliation Committee from 2008 to 2015. They're a little bit ahead of the ball on this. We're just starting. So it's going to be a long road, but I think Deb Haaland's presence is first and foremost why we're seeing this happen. In addition, I think the political news around the recent discoveries, both in Canada as well as in the U.S., you're talking close to or over 1,000 Indigenous children's remains being found within a month. So I think that also obviously maybe spurred to action plans that were already in place.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of these boarding schools, how they came to be, maybe beginning with the Civilization Fund Act of 1819?
You have to frame it within the broader context of colonization in the United States. Much of the efforts of colonization were a little bit more disparate to start and weren't quite as organized. So what you saw, a lot of the conditions that we can maybe get into here in a second, were kind of formed more in these missions that would be run, church run, or in these forts, which would be a combination of church and whatever European government, or eventually would turn into the American government being run. And the idea behind these missions and forts were varied, but the overarching design for those was to kind of slowly begin to extract the culture and the language from Indigenous people and assimilate them. But it wasn't done in quite an industrialized fashion because Indigenous nations remained very strong Indigenous nations, which they do today as well. I think the problem was that after westward expansion, kind of through the mid-19th century, the United States started really taking a hard look at destabilizing, but they actively wanted to remove tribal nations as political entities. And as many colonizing forces have done over the years, they recognize that the fastest way to that is to go through the children. And so you started with the first, kind of official federally run boarding school being the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, which operated, 1879 to 1918. And then that kind of kicked off a much larger expeditious trend by the United States government, and Canada was also doing its thing at the same time. And ultimately by the end of it, I think we had close to over 350 boarding schools by this time it was said and done in the 1980s and 1990s when they finally transitioned fully into these current Bureau of Indian Education schools that are still operating today.
Pause. They're still operating today.
Yeah. So when I say that, I don't mean that they're operating in the same function, but many of the same exact school grounds and school facilities have been repurposed by the Bureau of Indian Education, which by treaty and trust responsibility, along with things like the Indian Health Service, it is one function of the federal government to provide education for tribal communities.
So talk to me just a bit about what the experience was like for children in these schools under that sort of more oppressive regime that we've just been talking about.
Yeah, and I want to be really careful here. We are talking about things that happened in the 19th century, but these also happen. There are people alive today who went through these schools, who live with, you know, active scarring emotionally, spiritually, physically, because of the conditions at these schools. So, you know, I don't want to be overly gratuitous or anything disrespectful towards those experiences. And I think this is maybe more of a meta commentary than anything, but I do think that, you know, like I said earlier, Canada is probably over a decade ahead of us on this. And just in terms of trying to build some sort of public acknowledgement of just how horrific these schools were for the children that were forced to go there. And you're talking in the thousands, tens of thousands, and it was very mechanical. And that's where I get when I'm faced with a question of describe what happened there. I foresee over the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be lots of opportunities, I think, for living survivors to tell their stories in more prominent ways and be given the platforms that they deserve. These were places where the children's well-being was the absolute last thought on the list. These were not schools. They could even call them, like we use this term, and Canada uses residential schools. We call them boarding schools. The problem that we're going to face over the coming years, I think, and this is something we face a lot with just basic, I think, language impediments, which is that if you talk to most Americans and you ask them about boarding schools and you just left it at that, their mind is going to some Northeastern prep school to feed into an Ivy League or something like that. And if you ask any Indigenous person, like, you're getting a completely different reaction. So I think that terminology boarding school is so light as to what happened there. I mean, these are places where children were literally sold out for free labor to nearby farms and factories, where they had their hair cut, they had their language stripped from their mouths, or they were physically reprimanded. Like, these were things, and much, much worse. So I just think that we're going to, as I kind of take a step out of my body here and look from 30,000 feet, I do think, you know, as we move forward and we try to get into facing the truth of what happened at these schools, we're also going to have to face the truth of how to communicate that to a public that doesn't have a clue of the recency of it, but also to the extent of how designed it was to do its specific function, which was not be a school. It was to be a place of assimilation and cultural genocide.
Nick Martin is an editor for the Indigenous Affairs Desk at High Country News and a member of the Saponi Tribe. Thank you so much, Nick.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Now imagine being taken from the only family you've ever known. You're then placed with a family that knows nothing about you or your culture, and your birth family can't do anything about it. This is not the beginning of some terrible movie. It's the reality faced by so many Indigenous and Native families. According to the National Indian Child Welfare Association, up to 35% of Native children were removed from their families by state child welfare and private adoption agencies. And that was until 1978, when the Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted and mandated federal requirements that protect the interests of the Native child, their family, and tribe. In their latest season, the podcast This Land from Crooked Media focuses on a federal challenge to the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Shockwaves are going through the Native American community, and that's after a federal judge calls landmark legislation involving Native American adoption illegal.
For the past 4 years, I've been following one case that's now sitting on the steps of the Supreme Court. How did this small step towards addressing generations of family separation become a target?
Back in August, I spoke to Rebecca Nagel, journalist and host of This Land.
We are telling the story of one case. It's a federal lawsuit, and it started when a white couple living in the suburbs of Fort Worth wanted to adopt a Native American toddler, but that child's tribe, Navajo Nation, had identified a Navajo home, and a federal law called the Indian Child Welfare Act said that's where the child should go. And so the white couple sued, and they didn't only sue to get custody of the child, which they actually won and rather quickly, but they filed a federal lawsuit to try and strike ICWA down. We're still waiting to see if the Supreme Court will take that lawsuit. It's likely. And it's a lawsuit that threatens not only the future of this one law, but the legal structure defending tribes and the rights of tribal nations.
Let me take just one more beat on this particular story. So these potential adoptive parents actually were able to adopt the child. Why did they feel a desire and interest in addressing this particular policy, this law?
That's a really, really, really good question. The story that they tell publicly is that they filed the federal lawsuit at a time when it looked like they weren't going to win custody and the law was threatening to tear their family apart. But we were actually, in our reporting, able to piece together a timeline. And they actually filed the federal lawsuit the same week the child's tribes agreed to the adoption. And so they basically filed the lawsuit right before the path was cleared for them to adopt. And so it's a really good question. There's actually, the Brackeens are the namesake and the lead plaintiffs in the case, and there are actually three non-Native foster families who are part of the lawsuit. Two of those foster families successfully adopted the Native child in question. So why they pursued this lawsuit is a really good question.
All right, let's back up a little bit so that we can kind of move up to the moment of this case. Why was there even a need for the Indian Child Welfare Act? What's behind it?
So before ICWA passed, like you mentioned up top, an estimated 25 to 35% of Native kids had been removed from their tribes and from their families. And two things were going on. One, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was actually running a program called the Federal Indian Adoption Project to purposely take Native children away from their families and place them for adoption in white homes. And the second thing that was happening was racism in child welfare agencies that were looking at, you know, Native children being raised by a grandma and other things that are really common in Indigenous communities and saying that that was those parents or those families were unfit and taking the children. And so ICWA passed in 1978. And I think you can really think of it, too, as coming in a wave of civil rights legislations that we saw in the 60s and 70s that looked at racist and abusive practices that were happening in states. And Congress put measures in place to prevent that from happening. And ICWA was one of those measures to protect Native families and to prevent family separation in Native communities.
It's a stunning reminder that, you know, there was obviously a moral, emotional, political, ideological outcry in recent years when we've talked about family separation at the border relative to migrants coming in through the U.S. southern border. But it is a reminder that family separation was not a brand new policy at all in the U.S.
Absolutely. The United States government has been systematically separating Native children from their families for generations. And so in the late 1800s, the United States started rounding up Native children and forcing them to go to boarding schools, which were really assimilation camps. And the explicit goal of those schools was to separate Native children from their tribes and from their culture so that eventually there would no longer be Native people. The same goal was part of the Indian Adoption Project, the idea being just that Native children were simply better off in white homes. And I would argue that it's still happening today. You know, racial disparities for Native children and for Black children within foster care is shocking. We looked at one case that happened in Minneapolis. And in Minneapolis, Native kids are 35 times more likely to be removed from their families than white children. In the state of Minnesota, one in three Native kids before they turn 18 will enter foster care, and Native babies, one in 10 Native babies will enter foster care before their first first birthday. For white babies that age, the rate is 1 in 100. And the majority of these kids are not being removed for allegations of abuse. The underlying things are neglect. And so this nebulous category of neglect is sweeping up disproportionate numbers of children who come from families that are poor and families of color.
Right. Neglect is often kind of a catch-all phrase for meaning poverty.
You know, and you can really see it in the stories that we tell this season. We go in depth in some of the stories that happened that precipitated this case. But like in one custody case, you know, a grandma had to fight the child welfare system for 3 years and then fight the white foster family that had her grandchild for about a year and a half for another 3 years to finally be able to adopt her grandchild. And, you know, the circumstances that led to her grandchild going into foster care in the first place was just that the family became homeless. And, you know, you can look at their story and see if that had never happened, that child probably would not have spent all that time in the system.
Rebecca Nagel, journalist and host of This Land, the award-winning documentary podcast. Rebecca is also a citizen of Cherokee Nation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Let's go to Oklahoma. Originally, this land belonged to Native tribes, including the Comanche, the Apache, the Osage, and the Wichita Nations. Then, in the 1830s, the federal government, under President Andrew Jackson, forced 5 tribes from the southeastern United States to move thousands of miles away, a deadly journey known as the Trail of Tears. Much of this land was then taken by white settlers in the following decades, and all of that served to lead up to U.S. statehood for Oklahoma in 1907. But today, despite the violence perpetrated by the U.S. government and settlers against the tribes of Oklahoma, Native culture continues to thrive. And on Saturday, the 39 tribes currently based in Oklahoma were finally able to open a museum worthy of their legacy.
Today, the first American's Museum stands as an enduring monument to the persistence and adaptability of those who have lived the longest upon this land called Oklahoma.
That was Dr. Henrietta Mann, a scholar of Native American studies and an enrolled member of the Cheyenne Arapaho tribes, speaking at the opening of the ceremony for the First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City. Joining me now is Dr. Heather Ottone, Senior Curator for the First Americans Museum and a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Dr. Ottone, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I feel very privileged to get to speak to your audiences.
So this museum was decades in the making. How are you feeling now that it is open to the public?
I genuinely believe that the ancestors have been holding this in their time and helping us to get ready, because we couldn't be what we are today. We couldn't have been this 10 years ago. We couldn't have been this 20 years ago. And so it's the right time, and it's the right time for the world to come and see what we've done here.
Why? Why couldn't you have been this 10 years ago or 20?
Well, just as from the curatorial perspective, I might just add that there are technology that we've been able to take advantage of in the exhibitions that didn't exist 10 years ago. We've really tried to be quite aggressive in thinking that while we're building a museum that helps to channel the voices of our ancestors, that we're building a museum for the future, a museum that will benefit not only future generations, but one that children and young people would be excited to come see now. And we've got 30 media projects that are in the galleries that the technology for them did not exist. And we're just really excited for people to come and see what we've been able to do.
Give me an example of one of your favorite exhibits. I know at the moment it's like saying which one is your favorite child, but choose one that in particular the public might be excited to come to see.
So in the South Wing, we've built two inaugural exhibitions. On the main floor, we have Oklahoma, which is in our Tribal Nations Gallery, where we speak to the collective history of the 67 tribes that were removed into Oklahoma and the 39 that remain today, and how these tribes were unique, diverse, rich cultural environments and families and groups before any kind of European contact. And in fact, you asked what was exciting about that. And one of the things where we really pushed the boundaries for what our museum can do is that we worked with four tribes. And as you enter that gallery, you walk through a theater that is playing very small snippets of creation stories that four of the tribes helped us to develop and cultivate for the audiences. We wrote the gallery labels in both galleries in a first-person Indigenous voice. And in order for our audiences to understand what is different about an Indigenous perspective versus any other, we needed to help audiences understand how we see ourselves within the world and how we see ourselves fitting to the natural order that the Creator made for us. And once you come out of that, you go into a chronological section where we look at the diversity of the events that shifted our world and congested us into this space. There are, and just as a good comparison for people who are not familiar with Oklahoma, we have 39 tribes here, and our tribes come from the Pacific to the Atlantic and from the Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes. And there are 39 tribes. That's not incomparable to the 44 tribes in Europe. And if you took the 44 tribes in Europe and congested them into a landscape the size of Great Britain, not even the whole of the UK, but just that one island, that would be comparable to what happened here in Oklahoma in this landscape about two centuries ago. And what our tribes have done to survive that, to resist cultural assimilation, and the really vibrant culture that lives here now. And when I say culture, I don't just mean, you know, dances and food, but the really diverse economic impacts that our tribes have. Over a quarter of all Native Americans are tribally affiliated in tribes in Oklahoma. And our second exhibition is Winneco, Life of an Object, Selections from the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. And this exhibition, we were our museum staff, and I co-curated this with Willena Quiton, who's a member of the Osage Nation and also Muscogee Creek and Cherokee. And she had been on this project a little longer than I had and had been able to identify and become familiar with the objects that represented our 39 tribes. And she and I created a framework through which we could make selections. We then consulted back with the tribes to see if these would be appropriate to represent them out of the national collection. For many other tribes, for most of the tribes, they were acceptable, and they were actually quite proud and happy to have these objects return to Oklahoma, where many of them, the majority of them, were collected between 1908 and 1914. But there were tribes that actually refused to use the objects from the national collection, and we cooperated with those tribes to identify alternates. Because, of course, we still wanted the tribes represented. And so for the alternates, we did a range of loans from the tribal museums or tribal collections or commissions directly to their community members. But for those objects that came back from the Smithsonian to Oklahoma, we have worked with the National Museum of the American Indian, who's been a fantastic partner, to conserve them and stabilize them for travel and for a long-term exhibition. And then for nine of them, through Willena's research in the archival notes from the collector, she was able to identify the descendants of nine of the families. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to reunite those families with those objects. And I consider this probably the height of the most critical point that our museum might take, the path our museum might take over what another museum might do. It's not simply about putting those objects on exhibition, because really anybody can do that. But for us to be able to reconnect these objects with their families, to me, that's the profound difference of Indigenous curators working in the field.
Can you talk a bit more about the tensions for a public historian, for a museum? Or maybe they aren't tensions, the way that you reconcile
the observation of outsiders, those to whom these objects do not belong, where there is not this either familial or tribal or sacred connection, these audiences, versus that capacity, as you just said, to return these to families and communities where they do have this particular meaning. What are the multiple goals of the museum?
Well, thank you. That's a great question, because our museum really was founded with the intention of telling the story of our tribes, and uniquely so from a Native perspective. You asked earlier, what are some of the things that have changed that make now the right time? And I would say that one of the biggest advances has been the capacity for there to be a Native American tribal member who can be experienced leader for our institution. So James Prepper Henry, who's a citizen of the Kaw Nation, also descended from the Muscogee Creek Nation. He's actually currently vice chair of his tribe as he's serving there and serving this museum. Equally so, 12 years ago, when I started curating at the University of Oklahoma, I was one of only three Native Americans curating in a non-tribal or non-federal museum. The field has expanded, and we were able to build an entirely Native curatorial team to tell a story in a manner that is both bold and aggressive, in that we didn't shy away from the difficult components of our stories, but also absolutely an act of deep respect and responsibility for telling those stories that our ancestors would never have been able to have the opportunity of a museum where they would be seen as an authority. It may be the greatest honor of my career, but it was also a great burden. And figuring out how we could represent 39 tribes, our curatorial team of 11 was all tribal citizens. Really, we had to dig deep in order to be able to represent stories for tribes who were not represented by a member on the curatorial team, and especially those smaller tribes for whom there's a real dearth in the scholarship. So we're really pleased with what we've been able to do. One of the tasks I've carried for the last couple of weeks as we've been preparing to open, we actually prepared the galleries in advance to give us enough time to start taking tribal leaders through the galleries and give them a chance to see what we've done, and letting them tell us where they would like things to be improved. Not just letting them, but asking them, what would you like to do? Because we're going to be here for 100 years. This is only just the beginning, and we've got to build the relationships upon which we can rely to become an institution that is really deserving of the name of First Americans Museum.
Dr. Heather Atone, thank you for taking on this burden and this honor with such respect and reciprocity. Dr. Atone is the senior curator for the First Americans Museum and a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Dr. Atone, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
We're continuing with news affecting Indigenous communities. Let's go to Wyoming. Last month, the body of 22-year-old Gabby Petito was found in Wyoming. And this came after a 9-day search following the filing of a missing persons report by her family. Gabby's case continues to garner a lot of social media and mainstream media coverage. And it should. But many other young women go missing and don't get the same level of attention. According to a report released in January by the state's Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Task Force, in the state of Wyoming, between 2011 and 2020, 710 Indigenous people went missing. 85% of them are kids, and 57% are female. Now, we're going to link a great piece from The Insider up at thetakeaway.org for you, and it really dives deep into this issue. The report also shows that media coverage numbers are pretty astonishing, as in astonishingly low, with only 30% of Indigenous homicide victims making the news. Compare that to a little over half of white victims. And Indigenous female homicide victims had the lowest level of newspaper media coverage, just 18%. I spoke with Mary Catherine Nagel, partner at Pipestem and Nagel Law Firm. It's a firm specializing in tribal sovereignty of Native nations and peoples, and Mary Catherine is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. We spoke with her sister Rebecca earlier in the show.
When you saw the response of the FBI in the Gabby Petito case, how did you respond?
Well, first and foremost, I just want to say that no family should have to go through what Gabby's family is going through. And my heart breaks for them and for her. She's lost her life. And so I speak to you today with a great amount of sorrow and compassion for her family. But when it comes to the FBI, I think what they've done for Gabby and for Gabby's family demonstrates what they are more than capable of doing for the hundreds and thousands of Indigenous women, children, and people in the United States who go missing and are murdered every I can't speak with specific data because so many of them are mislabeled by law enforcement as suicide or runaways when, much like this unfortunate tragic case, there are incredibly suspicious circumstances. And the FBI, despite having jurisdiction over Indian country lands or reservations, tribal lands, like they do, national parks, have jurisdiction, they have the capability, they have the resources in many instances, they have the technology, they have the mandate, they have the federal trust duty and responsibility to investigate, and they simply are not.
So clarify why it's the FBI who's doing these, or in this case, refusing to do these investigations.
Sure. So there's a sovereign to sovereign relationship between the tribal nations that predate the existence of the United States and the United States itself. And that is for many reasons, one of which is that when the United States first came into existence, one of the very first things this country did to legitimize its existence within the international community was sign treaties with tribal nations. And that was how it showed France, Britain, Spain, hey, we can do what you do too. We can also sign treaties with these tribal nations just like you have. Those treaties guarantee several rights, and they were, of course, made in exchange for the hundreds of millions of acres that now comprise the United States. And within those treaties are guarantees of protection and duties of protection. And as Secretary Holland has noted many times since becoming the first Native woman Secretary of the Department of Interior, those treaties contain federal trust duties and responsibilities. And President Biden has acknowledged this as well. The federal government has a federal trust duty and responsibility to the citizens of our tribal nations.
In this case, even as I was introducing it, I felt that tension between being able to say and speak Gabby Petito's name, having images of her in my head from the again, heartbreaking video that we've seen of such an alive young person cut short. But I couldn't say the names. I could only give, you know, stats. Can you help us first by maybe humanizing in at least one case an Indigenous woman or child who's missing, who we don't know what's happened?
Sure. I mean, there are so many. I could talk to you for hours. It's hard to say why, but for whatever reason, Olivia Lone Bear's case is really jumping to mind immediately. And that's probably because her brother Matthew fought for almost an entire year. I believe it was 10 months, but I might be off. It could be 11 or 12. Fought very hard to get the FBI to investigate the murder of his sister who went missing on the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. FBI refused and refused and refused. Her family had to get attorneys to call then Senator Heitkamp and ask Senator Heitkamp to advocate. Senator Heitkamp then, who doesn't have direct line authority over the FBI, but as a senator in the United States Congress, said to the FBI, please investigate this missing Indigenous woman on the Fort Berthold Reservation. And her brother kept saying, search the lakes, search the lakes. There are so many lakes up there, man-made lakes from the Army Corps of Engineers, another catastrophe by the federal government. But put that aside, they finally, 10 months later, investigated Lake Sakakawea and dredged up her truck, which was at the bottom of the lake. And when they did that, she was seat-belted in to the passenger side alone in the truck at the bottom of the lake. This is a mother, a young mother of young, young children. And her brother said there's no way she would have driven her truck, abandoned her children into the bottom of the lake. She was murdered. And the federal authorities who pulled her body out of the lake said, well, it's probably a suicide here and they're not investigating it as a homicide. So that's the kind of treatment that Native women get when they go missing. I mean, I represent the family of Kaysera Stops Pretty Places. And her body was found 5 days after she went missing in a busy intersection in a suburban area in Hardin, Montana. I visited that spot. If you stand there, a car drives by every 15 to 30 seconds during the day. You can see the flowers and the cross that her family and friends have left there. And the FBI has said, well, the only conclusion you can draw here is that her body laid there for 5 days because her body was pretty badly decomposed when it was discovered. And they said, well, she just laid there for 5 days until she was discovered, even though the family insisted that her body was dropped there and that she was murdered elsewhere. Because it's just very obvious that her body would have been seen by everyone who was searching for her if her body had truly been laying there for 5 days straight, which we know it has not been. They have not done an investigation. Her body was found half a mile off the Crow Reservation border. And because her body was discovered half a mile, because their theory is that she laid there for 5 days straight, they have refused to investigate or even talk to the family, honestly, and do an interview, which would be a great first step. And they have not done that.
All right. First of all, thank you for sharing those stories, which are just brutal and shocking that they are not a regular part of our news, that we're not hearing that and talking about it and finding a way to put public pressure, right? This is part of what happens when families lose loved ones under these difficult circumstances, is that sometimes kind of that public pressure helps to push investigations forward. So Mary Catherine, let me ask just one last question. What are the key changes from what you've seen here that need to happen from top down or from bottom up, particularly given this question of sovereignty and jurisdiction that you just discussed?
Well, I really appreciate that question, because it's one thing to talk about the problem, but we love talking about the solution because we want to save lives. I don't want to just keep appearing on these programs every time a Native woman or girl is murdered. We want to stop it from happening. And my other client that I represent on a daily basis is the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, NIWRC, headquartered in Montana. They're a national nonprofit working to end violence against Native women and girls. And one of the main goals we have is the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. We are actively working and advocating for Congress to restore the tribal criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians that the Supreme Court took away in 1978. And we've made great progress. And of course, we got a House version of that bill, H.R. 1620, through the House. It's bipartisan. Republicans and Democrats supported restoration of tribal criminal jurisdiction for many crimes that ultimately result in homicide, including trafficking, stranger sexual assault, and child abuse, elder abuse. And that bill is stalled in the Senate right now. We have heard good news that Republicans and Democrats are trying to work together, but it has taken quite some time, and we're still advocating for the Senate to prioritize this critical, critical bill. But I would also say that while we're working to restore tribal criminal jurisdiction, we need more funding for our tribal governments. Because the federal laws that are in place, our tribal governments, tribal law enforcement, tribal victim services programs are not funded at the same levels that the state and federal are. And that's simply because in many instances, our tribal nations are not lawfully permitted to collect income tax, sales tax, property tax from anyone within their borders the same way states are and the federal government is. And the final thing I would say is, you know, our families have struggled with United States attorney's offices and the FBI to get the respect and the treatment they deserve when one of their loved ones is murdered. I represent the family of Lindsay Whiteman. The FBI would not answer her mother's calls for help or do a real interview. They came to the funeral and tried to talk to a few people at a funeral. And when people were reluctant to talk at a funeral, they decided there was no point in doing any kind of investigation and did not come back to talk to the family further or any other eyewitnesses. 2 years later, after really not conducting an investigation, they showed up at Lindsay's brother's workplace and just showed up where he was working there on the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana and said, here is the clothing that your sister was wearing the day she died. We're done with our investigation. That's how the FBI is handling these cases. That's not going to change unless from the very top, from President Biden himself, he demands that kind of change. And in order to carry that out, you're going to have to put Native people who have experience in this specific crisis at the top echelons of the FBI and the United States Department of Justice. The Biden administration has yet to do that. And until that happens, until people who are subject matter experts and who care about prioritizing this crisis, this particular crisis, get placed at the top of those federal agencies, change will not happen in those federal agencies. It's been this way for decades, and it's going to take actual people with the subject matter expertise being placed in those spots for real change to occur.
Mary Catherine Nagel, partner at Pipestem Law and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now that's our show, folks. We hope that you found the Indigenous Peoples Day special to be meaningful and useful. And if you enjoyed hearing our past content, you can have more. You just got to go check out our podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcast and other audio, or you can just head on over to thetakeaway.org. Big shout out to the team who makes this fantastic radio with me and who are enjoying a much deserved day off. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Our senior producers this week are Ethan Oberman and Meg Dalton. Our producers are Shanta Covington, Katarina Barton, Lydia McMillan-Laird, and Deborah Goldstein. Zachary Bynum is our digital editor, Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer and sound designer, and Jay Cowett is our director. Jackie Martin is our line producer, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway.